It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, our guest says conservatives have their own version of political correctness. He calls it patriotic correctness.
First, increases in health care costs have slowed significantly under the Affordable Care Act, according to a new report.
The annual report from Citizen Action of Wisconsin finds that there's been a dramatic decrease in the rate of health care inflation in the 4 years since the Affordable Care Act was implemented, compared to the 13 years before it came along.
These findings come amid Republican plans to dismantle the law and claims by critics that the Affordable Care Act has caused insurance rates to rise.
Despite uncertainty over the act's future, both national and state enrollment rates are up this year.
In Wisconsin, almost 174,000 people have signed up for coverage in 2017, compared to 153,000 last year.
Robert Craig joins us now. He's executive director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. Robert, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
Well, tell us about health care insurance rate increases before and after the Affordable Care Act came along.
Yeah, we've been doing this cost ranking report for 11 years now, and so we have data back to the year 2000. And so what we traditionally have shown is huge disparities between different parts of the state, and that's still the case. You pay a lot more, say, in Eau Claire than in Madison, for example, for health insurance. But for the large group market, that's where people get most people get insurance. About 80% of people get insurance through an employer. We were able to compare the 13 years prior to the full implementation of the Affordable Care Act to the 4 years since full implementation, and we found a striking difference. There was an increase in insurance premiums and deductibles of 15% per year on average in the 13 years before the Affordable Care Act, and only a 2% per year increase in the 4 years after. And so it's very dramatic, and it doesn't prove the Affordable Care Act caused the price decrease, but it certainly undermines the claim that the Affordable Care Act caused a large spike in health insurance costs, because hyperinflation has been much slower since the law was fully enacted in 2014.
If it wasn't the Affordable Care Act, do you have ideas of what might have slowed down the increase, or do we just not have the data on that?
Yeah, this data is not, it doesn't give you a causation. It just allows you to look at the trends. And so, obviously, there'd already been a lot of hyperinflation already. So, I mean, the price run-up we had from 2000 to about 2013 was historic, and people are still feeling the brunt of it. And that's partly why people feel health insurance is unaffordable, because it still is. So we're not saying that this is not a problem, or we don't have to do a lot more to make health insurance affordable. We think we need a lot more reform. But we're saying the idea that there was a huge spike because of the Affordable Care Act is the opposite of the case, that inflation has substantially slowed down since the enactment of the law in 2014.
Well, a new thing in that law is the new health care market created by the Affordable Care Act. A lot of attention in the presidential race to big increases unveiled this fall in that market. Fewer people getting their health care that way, but what do you make of those big increases?
Well, quite frankly, if you take into account deductibles and premiums together, right, then it was much smaller, about 1.5%. So we think it's been overreported. They're higher than we would hope they would be, in part because there are too many people with health conditions who've gone into the system who faced discrimination before, not enough younger, healthier people to broaden out the cost. Now, that is not a change in underlying price or anything like that. That's a problem with making insurance work. To make it work, you need a lot of people in the system to spread the cost of more expensive people. And by the way, what the reporting about the premium increases also doesn't explain is that most people in the marketplace get tax subsidies, and most people pay less than $100 a month, and a large portion pay less than $50 a month. And those are on the chopping block right now. And so if you look at that, the Affordable Care Act actually made insurance much more affordable for people left out of the employer-based system, people with pre-existing conditions in small businesses or who are self-employed or who are early retirees. Everyone who doesn't have good insurance at work basically has much less expensive health care if you take into account the tax subsidies to make it affordable.
We'll get more into the future of the Affordable Care Act in a moment. Looking at your report, though, you mentioned the disparities around the state. This is something you've been tracking from year to year. What does that look like in Wisconsin in this new report?
Well, when we put together all three types of insurance, So that was both individual market, people, insurance people buying their own, small employer insurance, and then insurance that's bought by medium and large employers. There's a very big differential. There's a 34% difference between the high cost area and the lowest cost area. The highest cost area being Wisconsin Rapids and Marshfield. North Central Wisconsin is the most expensive in the report. So Stevens Point and Wausau are very high, and between Madison, which is the lowest, which is a very large number. It's over over $2,400 a year. It's even worse in the individual market. The gap is over $5,000 a year. So it really does impact how much you pay based on where you live around the state, and it's probably a drag in economic development in the expense areas of the state, like northwestern Wisconsin, north central, and southeastern Wisconsin, that in health insurance is much more expensive there than it is in Madison, for example.
And why? What's driving that difference in those areas?
Well, it's hard to tell. We obviously, underlying medical prices are still the biggest driver because they're at least 80% of the cost of health insurance, and simply the prices hospitals, doctors, and pharmaceutical companies charge. So that's got to be their underlying. But we also found discrepancies between different kinds of insurance where one kind was more expensive than another relatively in the same region. So there are also distortions in the insurance market that we need to get to. And I think that what this really calls for is fundamental reform in Madison that actually gets at what the costs are. There was a bill that was introduced last session, didn't even get a hearing, by Representative Colstie in Janesville that would have not only required robust rate review for every insurance company that raised rates substantially, but for them to reveal, if they could justify the rates, why the rates went up. And that would help us get to the bottom of whether it's hospital systems, whether it's outpatient care, whether it's the pharmaceutical industry, or what combination of all those factors it is and why it's different from region to region. So we really need to work on that and get a lot greater transparency and accountability through legislation in Madison. But unfortunately, these kind of bills aren't being taken up by the current majority at all. They're doing nothing on health care costs.
Talking to Robert Craig from Citizen Action of Wisconsin, a new report on health care costs here in the state, a decline in the rate of increase of health care costs over the last few years. Want to get into, you mentioned the Affordable Care Act on the chopping block, but we're seeing more people signing up in Wisconsin on the marketplace nationally as well as compared to last year. Why more signups when this thing may be on the way out?
I think people know just instinctively that they're probably in a stronger position if the Trump administration and Congress take rash action if they have an insurance policy already. And they're not wrong about that. In fact, some of the reform proposals propose allowing pre-existing condition discrimination to return if someone's uninsured. If you have continuous insurance, then you couldn't face discrimination. So I think people realize that they're in better shape if they sign up. And I think that the problem we face in January is that a lot of people do not know what the consequences of these policies are going to be. And they actually, and Donald Trump and congressional Republicans ran on lowering health insurance costs and creating more choice and more controlled health care decisions. If they simply repeal the Affordable Care Act quickly with no replacement, they do the opposite. They force, according to the Urban Institute, 430,000 people to lose their health insurance in Wisconsin.
One part of a replacement that a lot of people have talked about, a lot of Republicans have talked about, would be making it easier for insurance providers, healthcare companies to work across state lines. They say that's going to give more competition, more choices in an area, bring costs down. Could that be part of a solution?
It does nothing to deal with actual cost. It makes the assumption that an insurance company that's approved to sell in Mississippi and not Wisconsin will negotiate a better rate with Aurora or Marshfield Clinic, and which they obviously wouldn't. What they could do, though, is sell substandard lemon policies that are full of holes and that don't cover anything when someone gets sick and leave them bankrupt and with hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical bills. That isn't lowering health insurance costs. That's simply selling a substandard and dangerous product. So I think it does nothing to deal with cost or affordability to allow substandard plans to be sold across state lines.
If the Affordable Care Act goes away, what would you like to see as a bare minimum in the replace part of the equation?
Well, look, you have over 20 million people right now that get their health insurance either through the expansion of Medicaid or that was in the Affordable Care Act or through the new marketplaces with tax subsidies to make them affordable. The problem is that when they repeal the funding parts of the law without replacing them, they're going to repeal the funding. And so there is no solution. that can actually cover people if you take the money away. The private market is not going to provide affordable coverage on its own. And we have a lot of people who don't have good insurance at work, and we're going to have an increasing number of those people as the economy continues to transition into more of a gig economy. And so, quite frankly, it's a very scary proposition that the money to make health insurance affordable is going to be repealed right away with no plan in place whatsoever that could possibly be viable for guaranteeing coverage to tens of millions of people. So it's a very stark situation we face right away in the early Trump administration.
We'll leave it there for now. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Always a pleasure. Good conversation.
That was Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. Political correctness is a concept associated often with liberals and often criticized from the right. College campuses are becoming common sites for tug-of-wars between free speech and the belief that campuses should be safe spaces for students from various backgrounds.
You might remember that earlier this year, students organized a protest against conservative public speaker Ben Shapiro's appearance at UW-Madison. Students who opposed his speech on campus said that Shapiro denied the, quote, realities of systemic and institutional violence against different races, religions, and sexual orientations. And critics of the student protesters argued that the effort denied Shapiro and conservative groups free speech.
Our next guest says that political correctness isn't the only story. He says that the right also has its own way of regulating what's an appropriate way to behave or what's acceptable to say. He calls it patriotic correctness.
Alex Norasta joins us now. He's the immigration policy analyst at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank. His article for the Washington Post on patriotic correctness is posted on Central Time's Facebook page. Alex, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Alex, why do you think that what you call patriotic correctness is a conservative counterpoint to the left's political correctness?
Well, it's a certain mode of speech and acceptable behavior, but it seems to be particular to those on the political right, and what is acceptable and not acceptable for them is very different than what it is for other groups in society, in particular, different than what it is for liberals. And what's interesting is everybody seems to be aware of the left-wing variety of political correctness. But when it comes to talking about the right-wing variety, the patriotic correctness side, almost nobody is aware of it, especially those people on the political right. So I wanted to write a piece basically illustrating that and showing that both of these political tribes have their own form of correctness, and they're just a stifling of debate.
Can you give us a few examples of patriotic correctness in action?
Yeah, I think one of the examples is the so-called war on Christmas. It's this idea that whenever you say Merry Christmas to somebody, they're going to be offended by it, and there's a war on that, and that's why people are saying Happy Holidays, which I don't know if you're in your personal experience is, but in mine, everybody says Merry Christmas, and I've never seen anybody get upset by somebody saying Happy Holidays. I think another sort of double standard is the common phrase or the common idea amongst the patriotically correct that unionized public employees are bad, and especially bad when they can't be fired, except for police and Border Patrol, which they sort of hold up on this higher plane of existence. So both of these, I think, are prime examples. I think another one is the recent outburst about Colin Kaepernick, who is the football player who, instead of standing for the national anthem, he decided to sit and then kneel. And then people got online and were burning his jerseys and having big temper tantrums on YouTube about it.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. We have a clip of one of the responses that you're talking about there. As you said, he was famously criticized also by conservative commentator Tommy Lahren. And here's what she had to say.
He's in a corner kneeling by himself. Why does that offend you so much?
For me, I know what that flag means to me. I know what that flag means to those that are fighting for our country right now. It's bigger than a piece of cloth. It's a symbol of patriotism. Our national anthem has meant a lot to a lot of people. It's got a lot of people through very hard times. And this country, it's got its scars, it's got its wounds, it's got its history. But I still believe it's the greatest nation on the face of the earth. And I believe if you live in this country, you can want to better it. But to disrespect our flag and our anthem in that way and not be your outlet to get out whatever aggression you have, whether it be passive or active aggression, I disagree with it.
And Alex, what do you make of Lahren's argument there?
Well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with disagreeing with the form of protest that that person took. But the notion that this is somehow disrespectful to everybody who's ever served in the military or is disrespectful to the country as a whole or that you don't want to better it by not standing during the national anthem is kind of an extreme leap of logic. And it's more just an emotional reaction, I think, to people perceived insult that has triggered a lot of Tomi especially has triggered her. To have an outburst in that kind of way. And it's frankly, it's kind of childish and pathetic. It reminds me of a lot of these people on college campuses, these kids that you mentioned, who get really upset when people don't use the right pronoun or there's a perceived injustice against a race that are just silly. So it's a childish sort of response that cuts to the core of a lot of people's beliefs, and it is very present amongst the political right as much as in the left.
Now, a response that you might take as silly or childish is one thing. You could almost put that in the category of annoyance. But do you think there's real harm done by what you call stifling this kind of discourse?
I think it's stifling that it limits the type of debate that people can have. It limits the type of debate over, for instance, a lot of the issues that Colin Kaepernick was protesting. We see it with sort of the criticism of the Black Lives Matter movement, which is, of course, far from perfect and open to a lot of criticisms. But the notion that by saying Black Lives Matter means that non-Black Lives Matter is sort of a criticism that you hear on the right, but then in the same notion, a lot of these groups have support the Blue Lives Matter movement, which they don't think means that police lives matter more than other people's lives, but they sort of go to the extreme reaction on the other side, which is just as flawed and just as insular as the critics.
I want to take a caller now. We've got Saeed on the line in Green Bay. Saeed, hi.
Hello. I think your guest here is mistaking expression of opinion with suppression of debate. I don't see conservatives lining up American universities trying to disinvite liberal speakers. But Ian Hirsi Ali, an expert in the treatment of women in Islam, cannot go on American campuses and talk about it because the politically correct crowd will label her as an Islamophobe. The story is well summarized in the letter of acceptance the University of Chicago sent to its entering class today. That tells you the difference between suppression of debate and expression of opinion.
All right, Saeed, thanks. What do you think about that, Alex?
So I think that's a good point, but it draws an important distinction. I think the politically correct are very good at punishing people who disagree with them. The patriotically correct, though, are very good at protecting their own favored classes of people from normal laws and normal prosecution. And a great example of this is the very, very high burdens for prosecuting police officers who are in a protected political class, especially amongst sort of conservatives. And it's very difficult in law to prosecute them for the commission of crimes, whereas if you or I or anybody else had done them, it would be very easy to prosecute them. So while leftists are very good at trying to punish and exclude people who disagree with them, like on college campuses, I think the patriotically correct are very good at protecting their favored groups of people from prosecution and other laws.
We're talking with Alex Norasta right now. He is the immigration policy analyst at the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank, talking about his idea of patriotic correctness, which would be the parallel to political correctness on the left. So this would be for the conservative, for the right. He says, use a form of patriotic correctness, which is stifling. And Alex, is there a point where institutions should be able to draw a line in order to serve its students? Should a speaker that has made racist, maybe homophobic remarks be allowed on a campus where there are students of color or LGBT students?
I think that free expression and free debate should be allowed. I mean, these people like Ayaan Hirsi Ali, by and large, are invited by student groups who want to hear what she has to say. And there shouldn't be any kind of rules limiting that unless that person is specifically trying to start violence. But that is up to the institution themselves. But generally, people have very thin skins on college campuses, and they should get over it. That's one of the points of being in college, is being able to engage with different ideas. And by building a safe space where you're not allowed to do that, you limit your learning, you limit your knowledge, and you have silly ideas that persist about the other side. But it's similar on the right wing or the conservative perspective of things. I mean, all you need to do is take a look at a lot of the patriotically correct echo chambers on places like talk radio or elsewhere, not this talk radio, but other talk radios elsewhere or on the comment sections of other websites where there's safe spaces and is not they're not allowed to make sort of certain comments that go outside of bounds. So it's very obviously on display in a lot of college campuses, not all of them, but there are many other institutions in society that are patriotically correct as well.
You've also criticized the persistent idea of American exceptionalism in your piece. Why do you think that's problematic?
Well, it's not American exceptionalism that I think is a problem. I do think America is an exceptional country in a lot of ways, but it's the expression of it. It's the idea that you have to sort of have this chest-beating chauvinism wherever you are around the world, like such as dealing with diplomats, like the Obama administration dealing with foreign officials, instead of doing a chest-beating nationalism, perhaps being kind or deferential to people on their own soil, is not a sign of national weakness or not an admission that America is not a great country. It's just being polite when you're in another place. And if you recall, the Obama administration was criticized numerous times for being deferential to foreign officials in foreign countries from this sort of patriotically correct perspective. And that's just it's just simply not a good interpretation of what was going on at the time.
And Alex, as we wrap up, I mean, are both patriotic correctness and political correctness symptoms of a polarized country that have trouble agreeing on something universal, like a fact?
I think it's. I do think it is related to that, but I also want to say that every sort of political tribe or every movement, cultural movement or religious movement, has its own form of correctness. If you go to church, there are certain topics that are widely debated and accepted. There are others that are not. In your social groups, at work, and in political parties and political debate, it's no different. The only difference, I think, is that most people on the political right don't know that they have their own form of correctness, while everybody knows that the left wing does.
Alex, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Alex Narasta, the immigration policy analyst at the Cato Institute, talking about his notion of patriotic correctness.
Coming up after the news, we'll look at the rise of stop and frisk policing in America and what the future might hold for the controversial police tactic. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, the world and characters of Middle-earth have captivated readers since J.R.R. Tolkien published The Hobbit in 1937. Now Marquette University has added a rare copy of that book to its Tolkien collection, and we'll learn more about the book and its connection to the university in just a bit.
First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Best known now for the movies made from her books, including Showboat and So Big, Edna Ferber was one of the best-selling and most prolific writers of her era. Scholar Bethany Wood shares Ferber's story.
Fish gotta swim.
I probably first discovered Ferber the way many people do, which is through Showboat, the musical.
Can't help loving that man of mine.
Unfortunately, her role in that musical has been written out. Showboat actually originated as a women's magazine serial published in the Woman's Home Companion. She wanted to be an actress, and she wanted to go to Northwestern. Her parents said she could go if she could pay for it. So she needed a job. And she went to the Appleton Daily Crescent at the age of 17, just after she had graduated from Ryan High School in Appleton, and became a reporter. And she later wrote for the Milwaukee Journal. And during that time, she started writing short stories and selling them to magazines, which at that time was a very common way for writers to make money. And she started writing what became a very popular series called the Emma McChesney stories that Ferber had realized were formulaic, and she felt that they had trapped her into a way of writing that wasn't going to benefit her in the long term. So she turned to writing novels at that point. She wrote a story called The Girls, which is about three women who live in Chicago. None of them are married. The problem with this story is that it ends with one of the characters, Lottie, going to Europe, and she returns with her baby, and Lottie is not married. Well, at the time, this was a scandalous topic in fiction, and Ferber had trouble selling the story. She shopped it out to several magazines, but none of them would publish it unless Ferber agreed to change the ending. They told her she had to get rid of the baby, and Ferber didn't want to. So she kept looking, and she eventually met Gertrude Battles Lane, who at the time was editor of the Woman's Home Companion. And she met with Ferber, and she kept asking Ferber about practical questions, logistical issues. Ferber finally couldn't take it anymore, and she asked her. She said, well, do you think I need to alter the ending? And Gertrude Battles Lane looked at her and said, no, I'm the editor. The baby stays. And Lane's editorialship of The Companion allowed Ferber to write in a way that she wouldn't have been able to write in other magazines. Ferber published so big in The Companion, as well as Showboat and other stories, and Lane really championed her dealing with subjects that would not be allowed in other magazines. Showboat, for example, deals with miscegenation, with abandonment. So the relationship of Lane and Ferber really, I think, helped shape Ferber's fiction at that time, and she created some of her best work for The Companion. I think her stories provide a picture of America that is very hopeful, that is very optimistic, that shows us that there is a very essential and key part of being American that is over and above our pursuit of financial gain, which is what she was afraid America was becoming in the 20s. And I think that that idea is something that we need especially now. And Ferber gives us the message that there is value in the struggle.
Bethany Wood is a professor of theater at Southwest Baptist University. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the show, 2016 is on track to be the hottest year on record. This year saw massive sea ice loss at the North Pole and in Antarctica, large-scale bleaching in the Great Barrier Reef, and closer to home, record low ice on the Great Lakes. We'll review the year's climate record.
But first...
Can I help you?
That remains to be seen. I'm looking for someone to share in an adventure.
An adventure? Now, I don't imagine anyone west of Bree would have much interest in adventures.
Nasty, disturbing, uncomfortable things.
That's a scene from the film version of the beloved book, The Hobbit, wherein the adventure-hating hobbit, Bilbo Baggins, ultimately strikes out on a quest throughout Middle-earth, meeting elves, dwarves, dragons, and wizards along the way.
And for lovers of The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings series, Marquette University holds an incredible collection of rare J.R.R. Tolkien books and manuscripts, and the collection recently added a gem to its collection, a first edition, first printing of The Hobbit.
William Fliss joins us now to talk about the book and its place in the collection. He's an archivist at Marquette University's Rainer Memorial Libraries and the curator of the J.R.R. Tolkien Collection. William, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us what's special about this new edition of The Hobbit that's coming to Marquette University?
Well, what Marquette has acquired is one of the first edition, first printings of The Hobbit. It's not a unique item, but it is rare. There were only 1,500 that were printed when The Hobbit was published in 1937. And interestingly, Marquette, with its great Tolkien collection and its great Hobbit collection, has never actually owned one of these for the nearly 60 years that we've had the collection. The way I like to think of it is that if our Hobbit materials at Marquette were like a smile, we've had this gap tooth, and now the smile is complete.
Wow. So do you have it already in place?
Yes. We acquired it recently at auction house in London. And so we have it and look forward to showing it at different presentations and class presentations and those sorts of things in the coming months.
It sounds like this really is completing the picture for you at the collection. Can you tell us a little bit about what that moment was like when you brought it to Marquette and you had it in your possession here in Wisconsin?
Oh, it was a wonderful moment. I've been curator of the collection here now for almost 5 years, and I've really wanted to get a copy of it here for the collection. So it was a great moment, and I, you know, to be able to bring it in and to put it alongside the other amazing things we have here, as far as The Hobbit goes, most notably the all the manuscripts that went into the writing of the story. It's just kind of like the cherry on the sundae, the natural endpoint for the collection.
Can you describe it for us? What does it look like?
Well, it does not have the original dust jacket with it, but it does have a green cover and some nice titling on it. And it's in beautiful condition, and it's absolutely wonderful. It was a real joy to pick up and hold and read. I immediately went to Chapter 5, the famous chapter, Riddles in the Dark, because the version of Chapter 5 in this first edition is different from the Chapter 5 that readers today will read when they buy The Hobbit at the bookstore and take it home and read it. Tolkien, after writing The Hobbit, was asked very soon after it was published to write a sequel to The Hobbit. And interestingly enough, he had no intention of writing a sequel. He literally told his publishers that he'd used all his best ideas on The Hobbit. He had really nothing more to say. But he dutifully sat down a couple months after The Hobbit was published, and he began working on a sequel. And for years, he would refer to it in letters as The New Hobbit. But this, of course, became The Lord of the Rings. And what he found is that in the course of writing The Lord of the Rings, as the story progressed in The Lord of the Rings, he found that the original Chapter 5 that he had written in The Hobbit didn't match up or didn't make sense with what The Lord of the Rings was becoming. And so he wrote a text in the 1940s, sent it to his publisher, and then beginning with the second edition in 1951, they put in this new text. So it's a different riddle game in the original version.
Oh, interesting. Well, can you give us some of the history around that first printing of The Hobbit?
Sure. It's a fascinating story and kind of how it got published. Tolkien began writing The Hobbit. We think the origins are a little murky, actually. It probably began as a children's story he was telling his kids, and he began writing it down probably around the summer of 1930. And he completed a draft of it around, we think, December 1932 or January 1933. And this is based on a letter written by his good friend C.S. Lewis, where Lewis comments that he had just read this manuscript from Tolkien. After he wrote it, Tolkien passed it around to friends and family. Lewis read it. And then he passed it along to another person he knew, a graduate student, one of his people that he advised. Her name was Elaine Griffiths. She later went on to teach English at the English faculty at Oxford. She, in turn, showed it to an acquaintance of hers named Susan Dagnall, who worked for the publishing house of George Allen and Unwin Limited. And that's really the connection that led to it ultimately being published. And what's interesting is that it wasn't published until 1937, although he'd completed the draft of it really in 1933. And so it was a story that he didn't write with the intention of seeking out a publisher. He wrote it because it was the story that he wanted to tell, and the publisher kind of found him, and it was published in 1937. There was a lot of work that went into revising it leading up to the publication. We have in the collection here at Marquette also the page proofs for The Hobbit. These were typesettings by the publisher that were sent to Tolkien for him to read through and make corrections. And usually at this point in the publishing process, when you get to the page proofs, you're usually just changing punctuation or capitalization or making little minor tweaks. But Tolkien was a fanatical reviser, and so he was, to the last moment, was making significant changes in the text. I think at one point the publisher was actually threatening to start charging him if he kept making more revisions. but finally then they did publish it, and it came out in this original run of 1,500 copies, one of which we now have, and which is just so perfect alongside the page proofs and the typescripts and the handwritten drafts that Marquette already owned.
How would you describe the relationship between The Hobbit, some people think of that more as a children's book, and The Lord of the Rings, which is considered, you know, his masterpiece?
Yes, The Hobbit is definitely a children's book. It was acknowledged as such at the time, although I think it's certainly a book that adults can read and get a great deal of enjoyment out of as well. And when he sat down to start writing the sequel to The Hobbit, it began really in that child literature idiom in a way of The Hobbit. It's very lighthearted. And then as the story progressed, it became much darker, much more mature in its language and imagery, and it sort of transformed into The Lord of the Rings. But certainly those first chapters, you kind of have a sense reading it of kind of the same sort of tone and style of The Hobbit, although that quickly changed. And he actually wrote to his publisher soon after, a few months into writing the story. He said, you know, the story has taken a turn, unexpected turn, and it's a lot different than The Hobbit. He was kind of warning them.
We're talking with William Fliss right now, archivist at Marquette University's Rainer Memorial Libraries and curator of the J.R.R. Tolkien Collection, talking about how that collection recently acquired a first edition of The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien. And I want to ask you about Marquette's Tolkien Collection. I didn't know it was there, and it sounds like you have some incredibly impressive pieces in the collection. How did this collection come to be?
It's an amazing story, and it's interesting because over the years Marquette has sought to publicize it, but just somehow it never seems to stick and always still strikes people by surprise. I think it's the sheer incredulity of the fact that the manuscripts for an English author who never set foot in the United States are somehow here in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, of all places. And it's a great story. It really traces back to the vision of one man named William Reedy, who was hired by Marquette in 1956 to be director of its library. Marquette had just built a brand new state-of-the-art library on campus, the Memorial Library, and they hired Reedy. He was a Welshman who came from Stanford, where he'd been working, and he had a reputation as a manuscript hunter, and he was hired to stock this new library with books and manuscripts. And he was aware of Tolkien as an author. This is only, you know, less than 2 years after the publication of The Return of the King, which was the third volume of The Lord of the Rings. And he identified Tolkien as somebody whose manuscripts he would like to get. And so he approached Professor Tolkien, who was a professor at Oxford University in England, and he approached him through an intermediary, a friend who he hired as an agent, and asked if he would consider selling the manuscripts to Marquette. And Tolkien agreed to sell them. And in fact, in 1957, the deal was done. And for about the equivalent of a year's salary for Tolkien as a professor at Oxford, and so in 1957 dollars, it would have been about $4,900, Marquette acquired the manuscripts for four of Tolkien's fictional works. The Hobbit, which was his first published work of fiction, published in 1937. The Lord of the Rings, which many people see as his great magnum opus. And then two lesser-known works, Farmer Giles of Ham, which was published in 1949. And then he sent the illustrations for a children's book called Mr. Bliss, which was actually still unpublished at the time of his death. And so those materials came to Marquette in the late 1950s, and they've been here ever since. And they've drawn interest and researchers from all over the world.
Wow, that's incredible. You have the original manuscripts of The Lord of the Rings in
Marquette University. Yeah, and when I say manuscripts, just to clarify that for listeners, it means almost all the material that went into the writing of the books. So handwritten notes, handwritten drafts of chapters, typewritten drafts of chapters, typewritten drafts of chapters with handwritten annotations and corrections.
Do you have the little maps he drew with the mountains?
Well, the maps and his formal artwork, because Tolkien, many people may not realize it, but he was an accomplished, talented artist in addition to being a good writer. And he produced a number of artworks for his writings. Those original artworks, along with most of the map material, are located at the Bodleian Libraries at Oxford in England. And that's really the other, I think, place to go in the world for Tolkien manuscripts.
Before I let you go, I have to ask, can anyone come see this collection?
Yes, anyone can come in and see it. There are some restrictions. People who want to interact with the collection either consult either on microfilm or in photocopy form. The decision was made many years ago by Marquette to limit exposure to the originals because of their fragility and their value. Tolkien was doing a lot of the writing, particularly of The Lord of the Rings, during the Second World War, where paper was scarce and the quality of the paper was oftentimes poor. We do keep an exhibit in our reading room of some reproductions from the collection, which visitors are welcome to come and take a look at. In fact, we're kind of a pilgrimage site for Tolkien fans who come from all over the country to just interact with the collection in some way.
William, thank you so much for telling us, and congratulations on your new acquisition.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure to talk to you.
William Fliss is an archivist at Marquette University's Rainer Memorial Libraries and the curator of the J.R.R. Tolkien Collection. The collection recently purchased a first edition, first printing of Tolkien's novel, The Hobbit. Fliss also holds talks every other month about the significance of Tolkien's work at Marquette, and his next talk is in January.
And now we want to talk to you. Are you a Tolkien fan of the books or the movies? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Want to hear your memories of your first encounter with The Hobbit, with The Lord of the Rings, and if you've passed it down to the next generation? If you saw the movies and thought they did the job or let you down, 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Maybe a favorite character, too, while you're at it.
And the eternal debate that I have with my son, who is 11, is which is better. And this is the films we're talking about. I've read both, but he has not yet read The Lord of the Rings. But what we debate is The Hobbit better or is The Lord of the Rings better? And he comes down squarely on The Hobbit side.
Wrong.
And I think it's Lord of the Rings
easily.
All the way. Come on.
800-642-1234 is the number to call with your Hobbit and Lord of the Rings stories, memories, favorite moments. 800-642-1234 as the callers come in. Clearly, Lord of the Rings would be the better movie. It takes three books into three movies instead of one book that should have been one movie. Stretches
out.
I only watched the first one of that.
And Rob, I'm assuming you're also saying this because sometimes people say you look like Legolas the elf.
Well, he's in both, though, right? Doesn't he show up in The Hobbit?
He is in both, isn't he? Yeah, good point.
Well, let's bring in our callers. Edward is with us in Stoughton now. Edward, hi.
Hey there. I just want to say that I do think the movie did an excellent job of representing the books. I think I'm one of the few millennials who realized that the remakes that Peter Jackson did are not just a remake of the books, but a remake of a... an animated that came out, I think, in the late 70s?
I think you're right,
yeah.
Edward. Yeah.
I remember seeing it when I was a kid, actually, yeah.
Yeah, but, all the detail that Peter Jackson and his crew went into making the movies, is it something that's taken directly out of the books, and you really would have missed it if they hadn't done all that detail. You would have known if you were a true Tolkien
Definitely.
Fan.
Edward, thanks a lot for that call. Appreciate it.
And you can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We go to Mike in Eau Claire. Mike, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Hey, I was in Vietnam when... we got some Christmas stockings from high school kids, and mine happened to be from Massachusetts, and started corresponding with this girl from Peabody, Massachusetts. And she actually sent me the trilogy of The Lord of the Rings.
Wow, that's memorable.
In 1968. So I first started reading it with the fellowship and thought it was boring and put it down. I transferred to another unit and was reading The Two Towers, or rather, The Two Towers when I got caught up in it, and I've read it probably five times in the last 40 years. So.
That's quite a memory. Thank you so much, Mike, for sharing that. That's all the time we have for calls. I'm sorry, but you can share your Lord of the Rings memories over at the Central Time Facebook page. You were talking about maybe a reread.
Yeah, I've read The Lord of the Rings twice. I tried for three and failed, so that might be another goal for me to start it up again, see if I can keep it going. Yeah, I love Lord of the Rings.
Thanks for your calls. Again, check out that collection at Marquette University.
It's a big day in music history. On this day in 1808, Ludwig von Beethoven debuted his Fifth Symphony at a world premiere in Vienna with one of the most recognizable beginnings in music ever.
The symphony got off to a rough start, though. For one thing, the concert hall was freezing cold. For another, the piece didn't start until hour three, apparently, of a four-hour program.
Plus, the orchestra didn't play it very well, to the point that Beethoven, who was playing piano and conducting, he had to stop and start all over again.
Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of inspiring in a way, like this disastrous start for what's become such a pivotal moment in music history. You know, I guess that moment of failure didn't set it back that much.
I think also the classical music then, I mean, it's kind of rock and roll.
Of the
Beethoven,
day, yeah.
Yeah, of the time. Beethoven got up there and winged it, and it's gone down in history, but it didn't start out perfect.
Right. So despite the rocky start, Beethoven's Fifth is still with us, a legendary piece of music that can't possibly be improved. Or maybe it can. Who knows? This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.